wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Every Monday morning, we bring you news, reviews, and interviews from a feminist, socialist perspective. We dig down into the roots and expose the hidden truths of our predatory society. I'm your host, Robin White. I'm here along with technical guru and chief guide, Patricia Kohlberg. Today, we're going to listen to Lori Mercier interview Murtaza Hussein about the military's effects on climate change. We'll have Bill Resnick interviewing Brenna Bell of BARC about forest management legislation and activism. We'll be reading an article by David Finkel on betraying the Kurds, and Jan Hocken interview with Lakota poet and educator Mark Tilson about activism and pipelines and water protectors, a fellow Pine Ridge enrollee. Let's go ahead and we'll go straight to Lori.
All right. Thank you, Robin. I'm speaking with Murtaza Hussein, whose work focuses on national security, foreign policy, and human rights. He writes for The Intercept, and his work has been featured in The New York Times, The Guardian, and Al Jazeera English. Welcome to KABU, Murtaza Hussein.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. We want to talk today about your piece in The Intercept last month that focuses on how industrialized militaries are a bigger part of the climate emergency than we realize. A few weeks ago, we saw a record 7.6 million people take to the streets around the world and strike for climate action, making this the biggest climate mobilization in history. This massive mobilization is encouraging, but as you write in The Intercept, few have made the connection between the role of endless wars in contributing to the climate emergency. So let's start with the biggest single polluter on the planet, the U.S. military. How do its wars and activities worldwide contribute to such a huge carbon footprint?
Well, the Department of Defense is the single biggest institutional emitter of carbon in the world, in the sense that it's a bigger emitter of CO2 than many industrialized countries. I think if the DoD was a country, it would be the 55th biggest emitter of any nation. And, you know, there's a very massive worldwide logistics network to facilitate military basing, their transportation costs, but the most carbon intensive activity actually is war. And if you consider the Iraq war, several hundred thousand U.S. troops deployed in Iraq, a huge amount of heavy machinery and military equipment has to be deployed across the world. And there were also bases, which still exist, which resulted in massive industrial pollution and, of course, the emission of CO2. You have to think of military activity as some sort of highly intensive constructive activity, except that obviously the intention is destructive, but the impact on the environment is comparable.
I think, you know, we never mind the continuing environmental fallout from the U.S. military's devastation of Southeast Asia 50 years ago, but just since 2001, this even accelerated industrialized militarization around the world and ongoing wars in Afghanistan and Iraq in particular have, as you put it, the U.S. poisoned the planet for vanity projects.
That's right. There were wars which did not necessarily need to have been waged. That's the issue. They weren't necessarily wars of absolute necessity. They were wars which were embarked upon that need not have been in many cases.
And you also write about some of this, destruction of the Afghan and Iraqi environments apart from the bombing and destruction by equipment, but even around these bases, the burn pits. What are these, and what have been some of the consequences of these burn pits?
These burn pits are used to dispose of military waste, and essentially, as the name suggests, waste is just burned there. This causes great air pollution to people living on the base, but also people in the local communities. And we've seen this in Afghanistan and Iraq. Elevated rates of cancer and birth defects in civilian populations who live in the vicinity of military bases where burn pits are operated.
And there have been studies that have shown the impacts on nearby populations.
To give one example, the city of Fallujah, which was the site of two very major battles during the first occupation of Iraq, it was described by doctors later on as one of the most polluted, industrially polluted places in the world. Sense that the impact on new babies being born and the existing population, cancer rates, birth defects, was significantly spiked from what it was before the war. And the ramifications continue on to the present day.
And depleted uranium, you report, has been used in some of the bombing campaigns, including bombing Syria. I think many people are familiar with the depleted uranium that was used in the first Gulf War that the U.S. launched. But as you report, that there's still depleted uranium being used.
Yeah, that's right. The U.S. military, responding to the outrage, they said that they would no longer use depleted uranium. And depleted uranium munitions, to be clear, they're used to against armored vehicles. That's the intention of them. And they said that because of the impact, the recognized impact of the chemical residue of depleted uranium on local populations, they would not continue using it. But during the bombing campaign in Syria, they did, as it turns out, investigation found that they continued using depleted uranium rounds. So they have not stopped, despite indicating that they would.
Well, what's been the cause of this lack of connecting U.S. military wars and this kind of environmental devastation that continues to go on, and the public indifference to linking those activities to climate change?
I think, first of all, CO2 emissions are very much an integral part of the way we design society as a whole right now. So this is just one aspect of a much broader system we've created in which all activities are very CO2 intensive as a whole. And this is just one among many, not the largest even, but it's a significant and very damaging contributor. But the second part is that the immediate environmental destruction is taking place in areas which are far away and not readily visible to people in the United States. As just as burn pits and depleted uranium not being used in the United States, were they being used, I'm sure that there'd be more attention and more appreciation of the immediate impact.
So it just follows the usual indifference of the global north towards the global south and the impacts of these ongoing wars on brown-skinned peoples and people far away from North America.
Yeah, I think that unfortunately that is probably a apt description of how this has been allowed to continue.
Well, it seems to me that there are a number of ironies here, and you raise one of these ironies about the Department of Defense. The U.S. military is one of the few agencies in the Trump administration that is actually actively acknowledging the threats of global climate change and the climate emergency. But at the same time, they're preparing, it seems to me they're in preparation for a future that is reeling from the effects of the climate emergency.
The military, probably more so than other departments of the government, is insulated from politicization of its activities. So, they have the ability to engage in their own research with less outside pressure, perhaps. And I suspect also because of the fact that the military, in a way, is more one of the very worldly, so to speak, departments of the government, and they very highly recognize that they have accurate information. They're able to be honest about what the studies show and what they're witnessing. I think General James Mattis said that he sees himself that the ice caps are melting. What are we denying here? And unlike other parts of the government, he won't be told to keep his mouth shut. He'll have more of a leeway to be honest about that. And I think that the military is planning for a future of great climate disruption. Their projections are very, very dire, very apocalyptic, what they're predicting in the future of displacement of hundreds of millions of people, wars and political disruption related to climate. Their projections are much worse than what's being discussed openly in public, in regular political discourse on the subject.
So what is it they're preparing for?
Preparing for, you know, wars which are over resources, preparing for refugee flows far, far in excess of anything we've seen to date. They're preparing for parts of the world which are no longer habitable, water crises, crises over arable land, all foreseen within the coming generation, not somewhere deep in the future, but that many people alive today, maybe most people alive today, will see.
Well, do you have any insights in how anti-war and climate activists can more effectively make common cause in the struggle for the planet and its people?
Well, I think recognizing that this is just one component of the same system, that their industrial production and the industrial consumption, you know, if you talk about endless growth, the economy being a unattainable goal, we should think of the endless war also as unattainable, because it exceeds our abilities to change the world using force, first of all, and secondly, the planet itself cannot sustain endless anything. You can very quickly destroy the world using the tools of industrial warfare, which I think people recognized after World War II. It's just that the impacts are more insidious now, given the climate crisis and given the impact of CO2 emissions.
Well, you referenced the Brown University's Costs of War project, which I always like to direct people to review, since its live calculator reveals, even to people in the know, such a startling, shocking, running total of the costs of these endless wars.
Yeah, it's an excellent resource.
And Murtaza Hussein, you have recently written in the Intercept about the current crisis in Syria, with Turkey now invading and jeopardizing the lives of Kurds who have been there under U.S. auspices. Is there ever an exit strategy once the United States intervenes in another part of the world?
Well, I think if you're going to intervene, you should make plans to stay there forever. And if you're not planning to stay there forever, you should think very hard about intervening. Changing the dynamics of a place which people don't understand very much, using money and weapons, you can cause a lot of harm, especially when you pull the rug out from under people, then they're left to deal with the consequences. So I think that what's happening, unfortunately, was not unforeseeable. It's just that there was no plan, and the way it was done, I think, is a good problem. It was done in a way which is very abrupt. It failed to give anybody on the ground the chance to make negotiations and make arrangements for themselves, which could have avoided what's going on today.
Well, and the United States has certainly played a role in creating monsters and chaos in places like Syria. So those kinds of interventions are never easily unraveled. But what about Trump's claim that the United States needs to stop intervening in and creating these endless wars over and over?
Well, I think that that's true. It's just that it's not very consistent, because at the same time he's withdrew 50, 60 troops from Syria and caused this immediate catastrophe, he sent several thousand to Saudi Arabia. And also, if he wants to unravel these deployments, that's good, but it can be done in a way which is orderly and planned and properly communicated and calculated so that it doesn't cause more harm on the way out. That's very important to take into consideration.
Well, thank you so much, Murtaza Hussein, for joining us today on the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO, Portland. And this is Laurie Mercier. You've heard Murtaza Hussein, and would like to direct listeners to his articles in The Intercept, important work about the ongoing climate crisis and crises in Syria and places in the Middle East. Thank you, Murtaza Hussein.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Laurie and Murtaza. Mr. Hussein is a journalist whose work focuses on national security, foreign policy, and human rights. He writes for The Intercept, and his work has also been featured in The New York Times, The Guardian, and Al Jazeera English. We are KBOO Portland. Now we welcome contributor Bill Resnick and his guest Brenna Bell. Brenna Bell is the policy director and attorney for the organization BARC, that for 20 years has dedicated itself to preserving forests, reforesting Oregon, and cleaning its waters. And not just reducing greenhouse gases, but also sucking up CO2, converting it to woody matter. They will discuss legislation for developing strong regulations that are resolutely enforced and making an informed, active movement.
Hi, Brenna Bell. Welcome again to KABU.
Thanks, Bill.
Brenna Bell is the policy director and attorney for the organization BARC that for 20 years has dedicated itself to preserving forests, also reforesting Oregon, and cleaning its waters, and not just reducing greenhouse gas emissions that come from logging and destroying forests, but also sucking up a lot of the CO2 and converting it into woody matter. Brenna started doing forest protection in 1997. She was arrested many times and involved in many lawsuits as plaintiff and defendant. She realized the movement needs dedicated lawyers. She got a law degree, became a full-time forest protector. Now she does it all, not paid much, I don't think. It's movement work, but still it's a blessing to have fascinating work and to do it with clear conscience and making the good fight. So with BARC, she still goes into the forest for sit-ins and occupations. She lawyers in federal court. She lobbies the legislature and Congress. And she challenges and sometimes negotiated with the Federal Forest Service and even sometimes the state. She also organizes the movement Building Forest Protection Forces, particularly building the organization BARC. So, Brenna, I interviewed you recently about forests and climate change, and you mentioned, but we never got into, how winning a fight with the timber companies or getting some really good legislation or even finding a candidate who wins who's pretty good. But if you do all of those things, that does not guarantee that anything will really change. Tell us why.
Well, thank you. First of all, thank you for that fantastic introduction. I sound like I've done a lot of great stuff when you say it that way.
Well, history will tell.
You know, Bill, I'd even go farther than saying not all of our victories stick, to saying sometimes winning can make can undercut a victory and make things worse than before. And there are so many reasons that that happens. I think the first one we have to look at is the fact that our legal system and our economic system and, you know, politics as we know it are not set up for us to win and have a meaningful systemic change where moneyed interests are subservient to the interests of the people and the land. That is just not how our system is set up. So sometimes it feels like one step forward, two steps back when we have some kind of victory. And I think that there's a lot of different examples that I could use to illustrate that. One that is really pressing right now is the federal administration's rollback of the National Environmental Policy Act as it relates to forests. So, you know, half of Oregon is managed by the federal government. It's either Bureau of Land Management land, that's most of eastern Oregon and a little bit of southwest Oregon forests, or the entire Cascade Crest, which is managed by the U.S. Forest Service. It's a lot of land in Oregon. So this has a huge impact on our ecosystem. Most of us get our drinking water from federal land. So things that happen on federal lands really impact folk downstream. And there's a law passed in the 70s called the National Environmental Policy Act, which essentially says if the government is going to undertake a major federal action that significantly impacts the environment, they need to study the impacts of it, disclose them to the public, and allow the public to comment and engage in that decision. So it was a way of making transparent the federal government's actions when it was doing something that would adversely impact the environment. And this is the major tool that BARC uses. It's the way that we find out about what the Forest Service is doing, find out the environmental impacts of it, and also we send our volunteers out to the forest to gather information, and then we give it to the Forest Service during like the public comment period around any timber sale or pipeline or things like that. So this is a big law. It is our foot in the door to daylighting what the federal government is doing. So that's NEPA. Here comes the Trump administration, And one of the things they said was, oh, there's so much litigation around the Forest Service not complying with NEPA. There's all these problems with how the Forest Service deals with NEPA. So we got to get rid of it. We got to get rid of this law. That's not what they said in public, but what Trump said is we need to increase the volume of timber coming from national forest lands, and we need to get rid of anything that stands in the way. Clearly, public process is something that stands in the way of getting more commercial product out. So that's Trump. Trump wants more volume to come off of national forest lands and to get rid of anything. And then we go to the law. And yes, there has been a lot of successful lawsuits where we bring claims against the Forest Service for them not complying with NEPA because they don't. They just don't. The law is very clear that there are certain things that they have to do, and then they don't do them. We go to the courts, and sometimes we win, sometimes we don't, which I can get into more about how the courts are stacked against public interest plaintiffs. But so sometimes we win, and the courts say, hey, Forest Service, it's very clear. The law says you need to do this thing. You didn't do it. Go back to the drawing board. And those victories are now being used to completely undermine the public access to NEPA at all, because the Forest Service, through a rulemaking, an executive branch action, has rewritten the rules about what a major federal action is that significantly impacts the environment to exclude maybe 90% of Forest Service projects from here on out from public review and environmental analysis. So because we were successful in actually getting them to follow the law, the Trump administration says, we've got to get rid of this law. We're not going to do it legislatively. We will just rewrite the regulations internally and write the public out of it.
And that happens with almost all laws, right? It's the regulators have a lot of room for either giving it maximum significance in the whole system, or in fact in minimizing it so that it's just a little bit of a pest that they have to jump through hoops in order to evade.
Absolutely. And the rulemaking happens in federal agencies, which are all under the executive branch. So when the administration changes, the agencies change, their directives change, and they can rewrite the rules to minimize the amount of work they have to do. The Trump administration has also taken on the Endangered Species Act through a rulemaking that is basically trying to gut the protections of the Endangered Species Act also for projects on federal land. And so we're in a moment where, you know, these are not the kind of things that movements typically are built around, like regulatory actions around agency rules. But when you think of what's at stake, it's the very door into the ability of the public to participate in land management decisions that affect all of us. And without a robust movement and outcry, they can get away with that. And part of the reason they're doing it is because we have been successful at implementing the law, but have not had that people's movement that demands, I mean, that was the thing that created these laws in the first place, was the environmental movement in the late 60s and the early 70s led to this whole suite of sweeping federal environmental laws that have just been eroded bit by bit by bit since then. Because sometimes when there's a popular movement and they have a victory and everyone says, great, we won, let's go take a nap for a couple of years.
Or move into some other kind of movement work, whatever it might be, and lose sight of the long-term effort to save the forest.
Right. And it's every movement. The Civil Rights Movement had the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which was excellent, but that's been eroded over years, and the movement also, you know, it kind of took a break after that. The culture didn't change. The system didn't change. The law changed. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion now about we can't just change the law. We have to change the hearts and the minds of the culture in order to have systemic change. And that's where movements are really engaging and effective.
Yeah. Let me ask you, though, it doesn't often require a change of administration or a change in the legislature. the corporations have lobbyists and money, and they're constantly trying to influence. Well, there's so many ways that they influence the regulators by offering retiring regulators very fancy jobs who have a great deal of influence still in the agency, or
right.
many other ways, or just promising the younger people in the regulatory agencies that they will get a really good job if they do X or Y. That's almost implied in the whole system, actually. They don't even have to say it.
And, you know, and another thing that's really present in Oregon, more than any other Western state, is the presence of corporate money in politics, and especially timber money. We have a supermajority Democratic government in Oregon, and they cannot, they will not touch the Oregon Forest Practices Act, which is the most lenient forest protection law, or forest management law on the West Coast. Even Idaho has better environmental regulations for forestry than Oregon does. And that's because the timber industry funds every single Oregon politician, pretty much. I've heard that there's one person who doesn't have timber money. I don't yet know who it is, so I won't say every single one, but the vast majority, both parties in Oregon, have some timber money paying for their campaigns. And what can we do then?
Well,
you know,
if you have popular movements,
there's no accountability.
If you have popular movements that are, in fact, challenging and powerful and doing vigilance and really threatening the politicians
mm-hmm.
and the regulators and
yeah.
embarrassing them.
That's the only counterbalance, really, to corporate money is people's movements. And this takes us back to the need for popular movements to hold the government and corporations accountable, and not just accountable, but to change them. Now, I just was at the climate strike with thousands of young people who were so inspiring, and one of the signs that I really liked, that I saw there, was system change, not climate change, recognizing that we will not solve the impending climate crisis with the same tools that got us into it. We just won't. And as long as we have an economy that is driven by consumption, I think there's another sign that said the growth economy is a lie. It's just like, you know, you cannot indefinitely grow and without killing your host. And the young people are starting to understand that, and that demand that they're not just getting platitudes, that things are going to change at a fundamental level, that, you know, capitalism needs to go, that corporate-driven policies need to go. That was inspiring.
Yeah.
I was so humbled and inspired to see them and see how they were organizing and see the intersectionality of the work that they were doing. I mean, they're just decades ahead of where we were, you know, as young activists.
Right.
And
well, yeah.
That, you know, I won't say I have a lot of hope, but I was inspired.
Yeah. Well, in some ways, time is on our side. Time is not on our side, of course, in climate change
mm-hmm.
or forests that they're destroying. They're doing it because it has feedback loops. It could well become an irreversible process.
Absolutely.
And that's a huge problem. But time is on our side in that a lot of these young people will get older. And also, the conditions are going to get worse, and the conditions getting worse is going to be enormously visible, threatening, and frightening when Long Island goes underwater, when food prices begin spiking, when the oceans are filled with plastic, when there's huge droughts and people on the move and wars for water. I mean, there's going to be a Pearl Harbor period when the U.S. and all the industrial countries are going to be forced into asking, how do we save ourselves? And we cannot believe the corporations, although they will keep trying to say we are our saviors.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me at that point, a democratic left force could prevail in directing and superintending the huge mobilization that will be necessary. At least I look at it that way. But we have to keep building these movements and also building models of what could be done. That's my theory. You get the last word.
Well, I think the main thing when we're talking about building movements and how those are the one thing that protect us from the steady erosion of our civil rights, our environmental rights, I think we need to stop having separate movements and recognizing the intersectionality of all of these issues, that the same forces that oppress people are oppressing the land, the same kind of capitalist colonial settler forces are still doing all they can to exploit everything for their gain. And if we see all of us as part of the resistance in that and united under the banner of climate change, I think that we'll be so much more powerful. And that's been a huge learning point for me. You know, I kind of came up just through doing forest conservation and have realized over time how the mandate to log the forest for corporate gain is the exact same as that which is oppressing people in places everywhere. And we need to all be in this together. And that social movement, I'd like to think, would be unstoppable. And when we start listening specifically to people in frontline communities, the people of color, the indigenous people, the youth, and really take direction from them, and those of us who are older activists, lend our skills but listen to them for direction, that's what gives me a little bit of sense, like, we might not get through this unscathed, but we're going to have a hell of a good time fighting together.
No question about it, although I'm going to steal the last word, Brenna. I'm a little concerned with the strategy. It seems to me that the cities, the population of the earth is now urban and suburban, a vast number of people. We have to change the way our populated areas work.
Yes.
And the people there in the populated areas who are not see themselves now as frontline are going to become frontline.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to put a lot of effort into creating models in those cities and changing those cities and changing the consciousness of people in the suburbs and the cities of every race, color, ethnic, and sexual orientation. It seems to me that our efforts, there's a lot that has to be done fighting in the cities themselves. That's where the people live. That's where the riches are. That's where the industries are. It's a strategy that has to involve all of us.
Absolutely.
Against these big predators and the elites who are not going to give up. Brenna Bell, all right, you got the last word.
The last word is we can never rest. We can never rest on our wins. That we just have to keep fighting until the system really, truly changes. And, you know, it's what makes life possible right now, is feeling like we're doing something in defense of that which we love. And luckily, there's lots of opportunities to do that.
And with that, the final thing, we need a good night's sleep often to never rest.
Yes, we do.
How about that?
How about
contradiction?
Just eternal vigilance?
That's not a bad one. Brenna Bell, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thank you, Bill.
Okay, so long. Give my regards to John.
I will.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Bill Resnick and Brenna Bell. This is Robin White. We're on KBOO Radio, Portland, Oregon. This next is a short piece from an occasional feature we have here on the Old Mole Variety Hour, The Well-Read Red. This piece is by David Finkel, editor of the journal Solidarity for the Solidarity webzine. Betraying the Kurds, First Thoughts, by David Finkel. Ultimate betrayal of the Kurds was almost inevitable, as has happened so many times before. But the particular way Trump's done it, right after a phone call with his Turkish autocrat buddy Erdogan, without consulting the Pentagon, State Department, national security staff, major allies, or anyone else except his own great and unmatched wisdom, is truly spectacular. And of course it feeds into the U.S. domestic tangle in ways still to unfold. I think we can fairly suspect that the transcript record of the Trump-Erdogan phone call has been stored on that same classified server with the quid pro quo call to Ukrainian President Zelensky. And, as we've learned, those to other foreign leaders are stashed to stay safe from the reach of whistleblowers and congressional investigators. It might be inconvenient to reveal that Trump made sure Erdogan knew that the coast was clear for his long-planned invasion of northern Syria. In the present case, there wasn't even a material imperial interest in pulling out and leaving the Kurdish forces and civilian population hung out to dry. It was just Trump's whim. Keep in mind that the U.S. force in northeastern Syria is hardly a big strike force. It is, or was, a small presence as a tripwire against Turkish incursion and a logistical intelligence support for the Kurdish forces fighting the Islamic State, ISIS. Pulling it out doesn't represent a U.S. withdrawal from endless Middle East wars, as the big twit boasts, but those troops won't be coming home. They'll be redeployed in Iraq or somewhere nearby. After the fact, Trump blustered that he'll destroy the Turkish economy if its invasion crosses some unspecified limits. No one takes that drivel seriously, not Erdogan, not the tens of thousands of fleeing civilians, not the United States' European allies, not the Syrian regime or the Iran or Russia that are contemplating how they might move into the vacuum, and not ISIS, whose potential revival is justifiably feared in global capitals. In his post facto blathering, Trump conceded that the Kurds did the fighting against ISIS in Syria, but said they did so to protect their own land. Of course. And they didn't help us at Normandy. Say what? It's tragic that the international left has no capacity to provide material support or weapons to the Kurdish forces and people whose aspirations for freedom and self-determination and the progressive Rojava project they've built amidst the Syrian carnage are being crushed. All we have are our voices to demand that the United Nations and Europe impose emergency punitive sanctions on the Turkish regime. The immediate prospect is a brutal conflict among multiple counter-revolutionary forces, Turkey, Iran, and Russia, and the Assad regime, ISIS. We can't predict the outcome or the magnitude of deaths or the new refugee crisis. One result may be that the United States and its promises are never trusted again, and that in itself is a good lesson, but the human cost is much too high. Next, we are welcoming Jan Hocken. Jan Hocken talks with Mark Tilson, an Oglala Lakota poet, educator from the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, one of my fellow Oglala Lakotas, and water protector on the front lines of fighting oil pipelines. Tilson reads from his recently published book of poetry, It Ain't Over Till We're Smoking Cigars on the Drill Pad. Tilson was at Standing Rock. He stepped into the role of a direct action trainer and police liaison. Since then, he has led trainings and teach-ins about the lessons learned from Standing Rock. He recently spent 6 months at Lo Esse La Vie camp fighting against the Bayou Bridge pipeline, which is the tail end of the Dakota Access Pipeline ending in Louisiana. He is still organizing with the water protectors in this fight.
Mark Tilson, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Well, you were in the role of direct action trainer and police liaison at Standing Rock, and I'd like to talk a bit about that later, but let's start with the title, the mysterious and provocative title of your fabulous new book of poetry, and then we can also talk about kind of the aims behind this collection of poems. It Ain't Over Until We're Smoking Cigars on the Drill Pad. I know tobacco has a long and honored place in indigenous culture. How did you come to this title?
First and foremost, I'm a prolific cigar smoker. Out of Chetty Shakoi, like I survived off of nicotine and caffeine like most of us. But the title comes from kind of close to the tail end of the camps shutting down in December. After the veterans came and Obama issued the edicts that there would be no drilling under the Missouri River for the Dakota Access Pipeline, that was issued from the Army Corps of Engineers, Dave Archambault II, president of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, asked everyone to go home. And, you know, I was interviewed or asked by a journalist, and I call them frenemies. You know, not exactly friends, they're not exactly enemies, a little bit of both. And she asked me, like, are you going home? You know, Dave asked, the chairman asked everyone to go home, or what are you going to do? I was like, it ain't over until we're smoking cigars on the drill pad. And at the time, the drill pad, I've actually seen a bunch of these. They're usually, like, really simple affairs. Like, it's just a construction site. At Standing Rock, however, it was like a 15-foot-tall fortress that was built out of these earthen blocks, the kind of technology they make fire bases out of in Afghanistan. And it was guarded by mercenaries and snipers and was wrapped in razor wire. So yeah, it was kind of like, for me, it was like this epic dragon that we needed to slay.
A military fortified space.
Yes, exactly.
Well, the you've been also very involved in as an organizer at Loyola V camp in Louisiana, and for those who don't know, that was the Bayou Bridge pipeline that was also the site of worldwide images of ongoing resistance from DAPL as it continued that last leg into Louisiana. That they ended up completing that pipeline, and there's oil flowing through it, and they went around the camp. But you've also insisted that it is not over, even though some would say that there was an enormous loss there, both at Standing Rock and in Louisiana. How do you carry the spirit of it ain't over until we have some kind of ritual pronouncement of a victory in defeating these lethal forces? How do you continue the struggle, and how do you see your poetry as part of that sustained struggle?
Well, twofold. Amoglala Lakota, history has been trying to tell us that we've been defeated for 120 years, and we're still not listening. We're still in this fight, not merely just for our own survival and our own lands and protecting our sacred sites, but also for the water, for our other relatives, for the world, for the earth, for Uchimaka. Yeah, and I think if we would have listened to the dominant narrative that, oh, you guys have been, you're done, you're washed up, we would have packed it up a long time ago. But, like, the warrior spirit that I feel inspires me is still very much alive in my people. And right now, it's probably one of the most exciting times to be part of resistance in my lifetime.
Why don't you read that short, their range of poems that capture the sight, sound, smells, and palpable energy of the camp at Standing Rock. I mean, it's in and of itself just as poetry, aside from where it goes political, as a political inspiration or social memory. It has a beauty that took my breath away. But let's start with Camp Life, one of the shorter poems. Would you read that? Maybe we could talk a bit about it.
Yeah. Camp Life. It's not that we were free, not really, but on a clear day we could see what freedom looked like.
So can you speak a little about that in terms of the something on the horizon? There is sometimes it's called prefigurative politics, or where you have these experiments and possibility that can't be sustained until there's major change overall, but something happened there that continues to inspire so many people about something beyond the fight against these lethal industries. And I know you've spoken about that, and your poetry is a way of putting some of what Standing Rock meant to you personally and so many others in this form.
Yeah, what I say is, like, we weren't truly free. It's like the Standing Rock resistance was fundamentally unsustainable. We required massive amounts of external resources in terms of just both finances and material goods. We didn't have enough wood. We had to bring in wood. We had to, we had to raise money, a lot of money, to sustain these camps. And so that in some ways that we actually had the support, though. That's what's kind of interesting and fascinating about Standing Rock, is there's often times where it wasn't the best distributed, or some people have been accused of gatekeeping the resources. But overall, like, we had access to a lot of resources most of us never really have had access like this ever before.
Because of support that came in from around the world.
Yeah, and what's kind of funny is, like, you're sitting in your teepee at the end of Crazy Horse Lane, and you're like, wow, they're doing a thousands of people are marching in Ireland right now for us.
Yeah.
And just, it's surreal, kind of feeling like, it was a very surreal feeling. But when I say that, like, what the possibility of what could be, we had our needs met, like, both our metaphysical, our spiritual, our emotional needs met. Like, most of us had better health care in camp than we did at Indian Health Services back on the reservation. I think the only thing we were really missing, like, really missing, was probably a dentist.
Yeah. Can you speak also a little about your role as police liaison? And you've some of your poems have to do with that. There's a lot of biting humor in your poetry. Some of it's hilarious and some of it's heart-achingly sad and joyful. But I think one part of resistance movements, especially now with so much focus on direct action, an area that's overlooked is the level of social organization, planning, and discipline that's required. It isn't just confrontations with the police and then getting arrested. And you were involved in that. Could you say a little about that? Because I think it is often misunderstood, the role of the police liaison.
Yeah, definitely. In the most ideal situation, like, you have training. I was actually at a frontline action and was just asked by Topkanka, who was on the mic, saying, if you're not Mark Tilson, don't talk to the cops. And that's how I stepped into that role.
You were anointed.
Yeah. Like, we had a lot of people who had a lot of different ideas talking to the cops. And people kind of think, like, it's a role where you're in charge or a leadership position. And those are people who probably you don't want those people talking to the cops or being in a police liaison. What you're simply doing is communicating. Ideally, in the most ideal situation, no one ever talks to the cops. There's not really a benefit that can happen as a civilian talking to the police.
In fact, ever. Quite the contrary.
Right. As a police liaison, your goal is to communicate, sometimes to obfuscate, between the action and the police. The idea is your primary role is to make sure the action is successful. And at Standing Rock, most of our actions were about work stoppages. The majority of them were about work stoppages.
Work stoppages along the pipelines.
The pipeline. Like, you know, we came to stop a pipeline, so that was the goal.
So, Mark, I would wonder, I'd like you to read in the beginning, in our closing today, because I think it also captures some of what I see as your aim of sustaining the lessons of Standing Rock, and not just in memorializing or honoring, but in learning from them. Could you, in closing, read that poem, and then we'll just say where our listeners can find the book. Can you read that for us?
Yeah. In the beginning, we sleep to peyote songs and raucous laughter, young men stretching their first war whoops and mocking rooster crows answer from the teepees. We wake to geese calls before sunrise, the loud yapping of packs of coyotes that always remind me of a small horde of freshmen jostling one another in the hallways, the bros of the animal world. If we win, these sounds will greet our great-grandchildren, and one day, I'll be there on that hill with white hair on the microphone, talking about these mad days when the Hunkpapa called and we answered. I might even embellish how brave I was or important. If we fail, only silence. I ask my grandmothers and grandfathers, living and dead, be with us now. Bear witness. Help us find the will to do what needs to be done. I'm not going to die here. I don't want to be arrested, and I'm too damn big to run. But I'm not a fighter, not really. I don't see what lies ahead. There's so much that could have been done. We've ought to reach out to our black brothers and sisters to stand with us. Send out our most respectable to every mayor's office, city council meeting, PTA, school board, and town hall on the Missouri. Every town and farm and community that drinks water or the pipeline crosses. And doesn't really matter now. We are here. They are coming. All I ask is myself is to live these next few days well. The camp is waking up. Hoka.
Mark, I hope we can all join in that spirit, and I hope to smoke a cigar with you next time you're in town in Portland. You may be here reading, as I understand, in December. Just in closing, where can listeners find the book?
Right now, I'm self-published, so you can find me on Instagram or Facebook, M. Tilson on Instagram. That's M-T-I-L-S-E-N. And I'm accepting payment through PayPal and Venmo.
Okay, well, Mark Tilson, thank you so much for being with us on the Old Mole Variety Hour today on KBOO, and keep up the good work, and I hope to see you soon.
All right, thank you.
Police get Chwabinito. Gnama see it Elijah Dim. Delpit Dowson. Eskimada Moose and Negnigan Minjasin. Police get Chwabinito. Ola bin again, mid again. Delpit Dowson. Eskimada Moose and Negnigan Sayasin. Boodleys get Lijasi. Don was the day born it by do. The dig bonic by do. Put a lease kitch, rubbing a hint. Can I see it Elijah dim? Delpit Dowson. Eskimada Moose of Negnigan Mindrasin. Eskimada Moose of Negnigan Mindrasin. Eskimada Moose of Negnigan Mindrasin.
That music was Emma Stevens. Blackbird in Mi'kmaq language. This young Native woman was honored by Paul McCartney for her native language rendition of the famous Blackbird song. This is Indigenous Day today. I hope everybody realizes that Columbus did not discover the Americas. If you're going to celebrate that, I guess you need to go to the store, get lost, and steal stuff from people and abuse and kidnap and rape and pillage. So please, do the peaceful way and celebrate Indigenous Day instead. Please remember that the Kurds are being led down a path to massacre. You know, let's try and do something about that. Let's try and do something about the climate. Let's try and be the good humans we are. That concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Robin White. Patricia Kohlberg has been our engineer. Thanks to all our participants today, Laurie Mercier and Murtaza Hussein and their discussion on military and climate change, Bill Resnick and Brenna Bell on legislation pertaining to forestry practices and activism, and Jan Hawken and Mark Tilson and their dialogue regarding water protectors and fighting oil pipelines. Also a shout-out to Emma Stevens and her Mi'kmaq rendition of Paul McCartney's Blackbird. The show and each segment will be posted on the KBOO website in the next day or two. If you'd like to listen again to the whole show or just one of the segments, you can go to the website and search for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We'll be back again next week with more news and reviews. This has been KBOO, Portland, Oregon. I'm Robin White. Thank you.